What would happen if instead of composing predetermined assignments, college composition students could compose whatever they want to compose? What would happen if students could set their own deadlines and grade their own work? Find out as Assistant Professor Mason Joyner and I explore these questions with a few of our fellow English department colleagues. I'm Monica Mankin, and this is the English 101 Experiment.
Welcome to the English 101 Experiment podcast. My name is Mason Joyner. I'm an assistant professor of English at Delgado Community College, and my co-host,
Monica Mankin, professor of English here at Delgado Community College. And we have with us today...
My name is Matt Hansen. What am I again? I'm instructor of English?
I think that's right.
I think that's my official title. Yeah, I've been at Delgado for quite some years now, about five and a half, originally from the Boston area, and now I'm very happy to call New Orleans home.
One of our invited guests
couldn't
make it.
He's just too busy having fun.
Because he's having too much fun.
Yeah. Right. He's enacting what we're discussing.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us today to talk about this concept of play and how it enters our composition classrooms. We have some readings, right, as always, we're going to start with. You want to tell us about the scholarship?
Starting with the scholarship, this is an article called The Art of Imitation by J. Scott Shields. So Shields is a high school English teacher, at least as of the writing of this this essay in 2007, at a high school in Arizona. And Shields is talking about how when they first started, they had to like also teach photography classes. They're not a photographer.
No, they have an English degree.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. But this idea of imitation as an instructional method is apparently a lot more common in art classes, like photography classes. Let's analyze this photograph, and now you all go take a photograph like this one. Shields started employing this idea of teaching writing by imitation, inspired by that photography class. Shields illustrates how this is done with two imitation assignments, one where the students imitate Dante's Inferno, another one where they imitate Chaucer, laying out the guidelines for how these imitation assignments work. And yeah, I think it's a good inspiration for old but renewed take on teaching writing.
Yeah. And we also have four poems that we like to bring in. They're self-portrait poems from four different poets. And one is from the poet Chen Chen, Self-Portrait Has So Much Potential. And a local poet, Charisma Price, I don't know if it's really an imitation, but we can talk about that if we want to. But it's definitely inspired by Chen Chen's self-portrait. Yeah. So that's included in the mix. And we have a self-portrait from our girl Vincent, Edna St. Vincent Millay.
Yeah.
And then also another self-portrait from poet Evie Shockley. Mm-hmm. Should I read a self-portrait?
Yeah, read a self-portrait for us.
Go for it.
All right. So I'll go with E. Saint VM, Edna St. Vincent Millay. Hair which she still devoutly trusts is red. Colorless eyes employing a childish wonder to which they have no statistic title. A large mouth, lascivious, acetatized by blasphemies. A long throat which will someday be strangled. Thin arms in the summertime, leopard with freckles, a small body, unexclamatory, but which, were it the fashion to wear no clothes, would be as well dressed as any.
Snap, 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 snap.
for Edna, not for my reading of the poem.
That too. Thank you.
Matt, thanks for doing homework. When we always ask people who want to come on the, on the show.
I thought teaching, you don't have to do homework anymore. I thought that's like why you teach, yes, right? Yeah. The students are doing the homework. Yeah.
They don't tell you do a whole lot more homework than they do.
Yeah.
One thing I thought was good, and it definitely hit for me because I've totally done this before. So I was like, it's a nice little wake-up call. She says, one way to guarantee poor writing, especially among low-performing students, is to give an open-ended assignment with little structure, such as write a short story about something that interests you. If a teacher makes the mistake of assigning a topic such as this, which I did my first year, he or she spends countless hours reading bad romance and horror tales that have no point and often include gimmicky, predictable endings. Yet if a teacher lays out specific criteria and sets limitations on what may or may not be included in a given narrative, the stories are more effective and creative. So I don't actually teach creative writing, but I do teach composition. I definitely see that because I will give people writing assignments sometimes and I'll just say brainstorm and kind of do a rough draft and sort of free write about what you're thinking. And I thought it was, oh, look at this. I'm the cool teacher who's casting off the strictures of boring homework assignments, and everyone looks at me blankly and I'm like, oh, wait a minute. This is not quite the right way to do that, because then people say, what am I supposed to do? It's interesting sometimes too, right, with students, like they want you to tell them what the assignment is. Sometimes they want you to do it for them, but they also just want that kind of happens. But it's like, you know, it's no, like, tell me what I'm supposed to do,
right?
There's one reading I have, Jamaica Kincaid's Girl, and we don't know how old the girl is, and so that's part of the interpretation, right? Use context clues to decide, is she 13, is she 18, whatever. And the mother's using some pretty loaded language. I don't know if I can mention it officially here, but
it's a loaded word.
She uses the word slut all the time. She says, the slut you are so bent on becoming, says it five times in like less than a page's worth of text. So that affects our reading of the text, right? Because it's like, well, if she's 13, would you say that to a 13-year-old, mother or otherwise? No way. If it's an 18-year-old girl, then maybe she's, you know, kind of grown up enough so she can handle that kind of talk. And so that's part of the interpretation. You decide, how old do you think the girl is? And I had one student who literally asked me quite earnestly, do I get points off if I get it wrong?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
The age wrong.
They're so worried about their points.
There is that sense of like they want everything kind of quantified. And like, I totally get that. And I appreciate that she's asking me that. But I was like, no, you prove to me how old she is based on your reading. Right. And so there's that sense of like they don't know quite how to handle that freedom sometimes.
I love so much about what you just said. So I think I also like that you brought up girl, because in the discussion of imitation, that's one of the texts that our students imitate can choose from to imitate, which always, well, at least my experience has resulted in some fantastic writing. But I think, too, like I did also highlight that part, particularly the bottom, if a teacher lays out specific criteria. And this idea of limitation, which I think also is interesting because the word imitation is in the word limitation, just to be a dorky word nerd. But
deconstruction.
But I was thinking about this a lot in terms of like the difference between limitation and prescription. Right? Because we've talked a lot about how we're kind of tired and of prescribing and like setting. It's like there's a difference between telling a student you need to write 800 words, you need to have a topic sentence at the beginning of every paragraph, versus giving them a text and saying, okay, imitate this, because while there will be limitations based on whatever the text is, there's still a lot of flexibility for the student to choose what they're going to lean into.
Yeah, limitations gamify the writing. It's like, okay, now it becomes, all right, I want to write about this, so how do I get this detail in there or that detail in there?
This is where Shields is actually quoting Edgar V. Roberts from Writing Themes About Literature, that Roberts' ideas are based on the premise that true liberation is achieved only through clearly defined goals. Just to make assignments and let students do with them what they can is to encourage frustration and mental enslavement. But if students develop a deep knowledge of specific approaches to subject material, they can begin to develop some of that expertise that is essential to freedom, right? Mm-hmm. And this is quoted in Paul Butler. After that, I underlined, thus, if writers do not know the options available to them, they will be forced to figure these out on their own. And I said, so this for me is really what imitation is all about. And it's through imitation that we are playing with the options mm-hmm. that are available to us to see what happens, to discover the effects, rather than to just satisfy requirements, I guess. Yeah.
I don't know what this guy
is. Hey, come on in, Brett.
Oh, there you go. Hi. Did you come by a second ago, too?
Yeah.
I thought I saw you. Okay. So it was our guy.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, come on. Grab a seat.
A seat and a microphone, and I got to get your level up. Okay, listeners, we have a guest who showed up here. Will you introduce yourselves? Not yourselves. Mm-hmm. I'm having a really strange day. Introduce them as well, by all means.
In the modern era, we all have multiple selves. No one could possibly have a unitary identity anymore.
I'm Brett Evans. I'm a Scorpio who likes Yakamine.
Brett and I actually have the same birthday.
That's correct.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Great birthday. Yeah. All Saints Day.
And how long have you been teaching at Delgado?
That's a painful question to answer.
Just
because it's like, wow, I can't believe I've just been at any same job for the... No, not because Delgado, just because I'm old. But it's been, I guess, 21 years?
Past 20, a benchmark.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we did get started. We figured you just were out off playing, and that's why you weren't with us. But we're glad that you made it over here today. We are talking about the art of imitation. I don't know if you had a chance to do the homework.
I didn't talk to the text.
Okay.
I read the poems that y'all were talking.
Cool.
Was that more homework than that?
Yeah. Oh, just the J. Scott Shields, The Art of Imitation, and those self-portrait
and the poems.
I read the poems.
You can have 50 out of 100 points.
Okay, yeah.
So, in The Art of Imitation, J. Scott Shields is talking about in his high school English class, he gives them assignments to imitate the Inferno and the Canterbury Tales. What makes the freedom productive is a small set of limitations. And so, for example, with the Inferno writing project, Shields gives them six limitations. One, it has to have a first-person narrator. Two, human characters. Just pausing right there, you can see that these are really not complex limitations.
Right,
Very general. Yeah.
Three, a guide who is leading the narrator through whatever it is, possibly hell if it's Inferno, and explaining what he or she is witnessing. Four, setting. Five, a depiction of the types of punishments and the condemned souls, or that the condemned souls will receive eternally. And six, the narrator's reaction to the scene. And so Shield says further down the page, I've discovered that with specific criteria such as these in place, the students move beyond the I don't know what to write about phase of the drafting process quickly, and they seem to genuinely enjoy coming up with creative ways of telling their stories, given those limitations.
I put a check mark next to that because I noticed that today with my students, we've kind of moved out of the self-portrait poem imitations. And just as a journal assignment today, I had them imitate the first paragraph of Mint Snowball after kind of just a deep discussion of purpose and how can we tell from the language she's using what the purpose is. They didn't sit there very long before just writing and then raising their hand for me to read what they were writing. So it does help, I think, a lot of students with that writer's block.
This is for a creative writing class?
No, this is for our composition.
Yeah.
I'm impressed that y'all are doing... I mean, we read a lot of poems, and the very first essay they write is an ode, but in essay form.
Nice.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly what we're talking about, too. Yeah.
But, I mean, I never thought of actually getting them to write a straight poem first. Sure. But basically, Mint Snowball is one thing we look at. But We just look at poetry odes and then try to like convert the spirit of that to a prose ode.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, I do couple Mint Snowball with Ode to Gumbo by Kevin Young so that they're like students will have an opportunity if they want to imitate mm-hmm. the poem or the essay, like they can. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, you have the yeah. total spirit of what we're what we're into. So. Yeah.
I like to start off with the positive.
Yeah.
Like, here's something you love.
Yeah.
And I mean, for me, even just in my own writing, I feel like one of the reasons I gravitate to poetic forms are those limitations and finding creativity within the guidelines.
It sounds like a lot of people have this kind of silly idea that like poetry is just what you write when you're sad and drunk mm-hmm. and your, you know, significant other leaves you and then alakazam, beautiful poetry appears. Yeah. And they don't quite realize that it takes forever and it's really hard to do and it's really exacting.
Yeah.
And so, you know, having those kinds of strictures sometimes actually enhances the experience in a way that you wouldn't really expect otherwise.
Brett, you're an accomplished poet. Do you feel that as well, that the limitations sometimes spark the creativity more?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's always a thing. Like, do you know the book, The Ode Less? I think it's called The Ode Less Traveled.
No.
That one's really cool because it's all these poetry forms and some like I'd never heard of before, like some fun ones like the Sanksican is like five stanzas where each line, the syllables diminish. They're really like short lines, but then it ends up this 25-line poem of really short lines, but it makes it move really quickly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As far as parameters, it's like, you know, to me, like the sonnet, it was always like just an amazing form because like 14 lines, not too short, not too big.
Yeah.
But like in the spirit of more like Ted Berrigan sonnets, like a lot of times I've written them where, you know, I've even done it to where the lines have to be 10 syllables, but not doing iambic pentameter or anything like that. Yeah.
Well, I think the reason we brought in these self-portrait poems as well, like Monica read Edna St. Vincent Millay's self-portrait poem here, is that sort of an early foray into imitation in our composition classes. And later, they might imitate an essay, right? Imitating the writing style of a particular
That's cool.
well-written essay. Mm-hmm. But we'll start with something like this, and we kind of generate those limitations together. We're not calling them limitations, I think, but what about this could we imitate so that a reader who is familiar with this poem would recognize it, and then using those as like little touchstones to funnel our self-portrait poems through. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
I'm always trying to tell them to make it as much. Anytime you find something you maybe don't want to do or initially, as much as you can make it like a game.
Yeah.
So maybe it's like rules of the game. Maybe is better than.
Limitations.
Yeah, rules of the game.
I like that
down.
Because every game has rules, right?
Yeah.
The thing that was surprising to me about the examples y'all had is I usually almost always gravitate towards the more experimental, but I actually like the Edna St. Vincent the best because it's like an actual portrait.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know? Well, the other ones are like behavioral.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But that strikes me though, like they might not be comfortable about doing like a physical self-portrait.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
So maybe they would go for one of the other ones. But it surprised me that I like Tars the best.
Brett, both. We invited you. We want to hear a bit about ways that you bring play or game, I guess, into your composition classes.
I mean, I always taunt them with the fact that Sarah Lawrence has no grades. And so, you know, that's just something they have to live with. But then it's like, because we have grades, okay, yeah, you care about that. You care about getting the grade. You care about getting it done. But as much as possible, if you can make this more for yourself.
Yeah.
I was telling them about one of my friends who's originally from Nicaragua, there's like a Spanish, in Nicaraguan Spanish, there's the word tresnochar, which means to, it's when you stay up all night until the sun comes up.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then that gave one of my students to write, she's doing an ode to a night that never ends. Mm-hmm. About, she really likes going on like ocean cruises, and she's met all these new friends doing it.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, as much as possible, you can think about it. Sure, it's going to be graded, but at the end, think of this as like for you, or you show to that friend.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's going to make it much more fun for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you find that students are able to dive into projects often that hold significance for them outside of the classroom?
I mean, you know, they have to want it, of course.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I just try to, you know, focus on that. Like, as much as you think of it as a chore, you're not going to want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be that. Well, I was just using the example of, like, we just went through the parade. The T-Rex parade, like, and of course there's going to be, like, 10 million pictures that everybody, like, looks at the mm-hmm. next few days.
Mm-hmm.
But I can also remember, like, things that happened on the route and people I saw and stuff like that, that if I don't write that down, even all those amazing pictures aren't going to quite get to that. So that's what I'm trying to get across. Like, there's still something that writing can do
mm-hmm.
that mm-hmm. pictures can't. And for you, not for me.
For you.
This is for you.
Yeah,
that's
beautiful.
That.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, I'll still give you a grade.
Yeah, still gonna grade it.
They make me, but
yeah.
You know, well, that's part of the thing. I mean, part of my philosophy of teaching is that, like, I think, and I've said this before, like, I think people are so caught up in this sort of cultural obsession with smart. Smart water, mm-hmm. smart cars, smart this, smart that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the implication being that it's like you have to be smart to understand whatever. Dante, mm-hmm. Chaucer, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and you do obviously have to learn and learn some new words and some history and so on. But one thing that I really try to do for my students is to, like, demystify the idea of being a student, me being a teacher, break down that hierarchy a little bit, and by play. I mean, you know, if you can get the class to laugh a little bit sometimes, they're like, oh, wait a minute, I thought this was, like, high moral instruction.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, we can just talk like people do, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's a sort of moment sometimes where they kind of go, oh, okay. And, you know, the references which are making the students write, like, Dante and Chaucer, you know, I mean, those are big deal authors. These are people who really, you know, left a huge mark in thinking and writing for centuries. But if you read this stuff, it's not all boring and musty. It's, I mean, you know, if you know about the Wife of Bath and you know, Dante's mm-hmm. Inferno is not, it's a wild place. There's all kinds of crazy stuff happening and really mm-hmm. dark, grotesque, creepy things happening. So who doesn't enjoy that?
Mm-hmm.
It's not this high moral instruction that everybody has to nod solemnly along to. And when you can get people to sort of realize that, like, your take on this is just as valid as someone else's take might be, if you're thinking carefully and you're using the contextual clues and you're, you know, putting together an argument, I think that can really, you know, make people feel comfortable. And that's when they start bringing in their own life experiences, their own insights, and the thing I can offer to, you know, the thing I can bring to this discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when that happens, that's wonderful. I mean, every now and again, you know, you just hope the ice breaks, but when it does happen, it's you can feel it.
Yeah.
Is there, like, are there texts or a specific exercise or activity that you do to kind of help break that ice, to help create that feeling that you're talking about?
Yeah. I mean, so for texts, I like to do movies. I like to screen things. It's a little bit easier for people sometimes because they're not always necessarily readers and they don't do a lot of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, visually people have been immersed in that since birth, right? Especially if they're in their 20s or whatever now. Mm-hmm. And so, like, A Raisin in the Sun, I teach that. I love that. And I do the 60s version of it with mm-hmm. Poitier and Ruby Dee and the rest. And, you know, it's something that we're like, okay, this is actually something about ordinary people, which I think mm-hmm. is very disarming in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And for assignments, we have something coming up, actually, which is going to come up in the next week or so, which is food culture. talking about different aspects of food culture. So there's junk food, where there's an essay about a guy who eats combos and he eats them for breakfast. And he doesn't even really like them that much, but he does it all the time. And, you know,
I feel like the students will identify with
that.
They're eating their
right?
hot Cheetos for breakfast. I'm like, is your stomach not wrecked all day long?
Right, yeah. And then you get into these conversations about, you know, like eating food that isn't good for you because it's tasty and you do it because it's quick. And that's a whole cultural thing, right? And there's an infrastructure built around that because it's like, yeah, the Burger King down the street is right down the street.
Yeah.
It's $5. I'm in between, you know, going from something else. People can relate to that.
And if it's one thing New Orleans students are going to have a vocabulary about.
Right.
Food.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I do. I was just about to say, I'm glad you said that, that I teach an essay by David Foster Wallace called Consider the Lobster. So he's going to a lobster festival in Maine, which isn't, you know, usually something that people can connect to because, like, what does Maine mean to somebody from Louisiana, whatever. But it's the idea of food as a culture, as an infrastructure, as an economic engine, and as going to an experience of the lobster festival. So it's not just you're there to eat, you're there to have a whole thing, and you rent a car, and there's, you know, music and whatever. So that translates really easily to Mardi Gras, all the different food festivals, Jazz Fest. And he gets into this thing about tourism. And being a gloomy Gus, he kind of thinks that tourism is, by definition, like self-contradictory, right? I'm not experiencing the local color because I am not from there and I'm basically just an economic, you know, opportunity. And so people can talk about tourism. And so many of our students are, you know, bartenders and waiters. And so they could say, okay, well, and then do you feel like a tourist when you go any other place than home? And do you feel like you can really experience culture? And people get into that sometimes.
Well, I had a question about Shields, The Art of Imitation, something that came to my mind, since imitation is so central to the course that Monica and I have been developing, and something that we've talked about maybe in every episode so far. This is on page 57. How do we avoid that pitfall of the, quote, the lamentable imitation for imitation's sake approach?
Yeah, that's an interesting section. Earlier in that paragraph where it says, more recently, however, formalist approaches to writing instruction that advocate for imitation have been generally discredited in composition circles in favor of more expressivist process pedagogies. I feel like it goes back to a conversation we had previously about literature's place generally, and that it's like this either-or thinking that, you know, you can't do both. Yeah. But I think that when you're having students imitate with the purpose of trying on different styles, and as we go talking about the elements of style, the different tools we have at our disposal as writers, you're giving them the ability to think like a writer. So to me, that doesn't feel like it's just for the sake of imitating something. It's so that they're getting that practice.
So it isn't just a Mad Lib.
No.
You know?
Although,
like,
that's also fun.
That is
to
fun
do.
For different reasons.
Yeah.
Very
the
fun.
Whole thing with y'all's imitations, like, occurred to me, like, I've always kind of lamented that there's no exact poetry equivalent of, like, doing a cover song. Well, yeah, I mean, you could be doing a reading and just read somebody else's poem, but that's not quite the same as, like, a band where, you know, Lloyd Cole can cover a Bob Dylan song and put his own spin on it.
Yeah.
But, like, I guess it's more analogous to the utility, the use of the imitation is, like, the Rolling Stones just were, like, a blues cover band for, like, however many years, 4 years, and then they're like, okay,
now we have a voice.
Let's write Satisfaction, and becomes its total own thing.
Yeah.
But they had to lay, like, the foundation of just imitating what they loved for a really long time.
I love that as an example.
Yeah. I'm really glad you made the music analogy, too, because there's the Led Zeppelin documentary coming out. It's already out, maybe. It's a big biography of Led Zeppelin. And I like Led Zeppelin a lot, but I think the Ramones have more to teach people and talks about the idea of play.
Mm.
And it's good for students in a way. I don't play the Ramones in class yet. But it's that idea of when you're listening to somebody, to a band like Led Zeppelin or whatever, right? It's this virtuosity. It's, oh my God, I could never play like that. And, you know, you put it, you naturally kind of put it up on this pedestal. But the Ramones, I think, can be more liberating and more, like, generative because they only know three friggin' chords.
That's always been my thing. Like, for me, like, I've never been – I don't really like T.S. Eliot because, to me, it's just like a dead end where there's other poets that just make me want to do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And my example with that was always The Clash.
Yes.
Like, they just immediately make – me want to write a bunch of songs. You know?
Totally. And that's the beautiful part of the punk rock ethos is that it's like you don't have to be a virtuoso. You don't have to do this great. You don't have to sing right, whatever. But if you learn your three chords, you practice them, you do what you can do, eventually things will start to build. Because, you know, late Clash songs are not like the early stuff. You know, even the Ramones changed after a while. But it's that sense of what can you handle? What is your ability now? And just do as much of that as you can. And then little by little, that will grow.
What a great metaphor for English 101. You know, turning English Composition 1 into, you know, or giving it a punk rock.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll add some punk rock philosophy to our lo-fi.
I actually made a punk rock reference today.
Oh, yeah?
Well, yeah, I just was trying, I gave him this, I don't know why this came up, I was just doing like a list, but I was doing it in reverse order, and I was like, you know, because we're rebels like that, a little punk, but the funniest, years ago, I remember being at this house party in Philadelphia, and like the woman whose house it was, like, had a cat, and there's like a litter box over here, and I don't know why, but a few people like lit up sparklers in the house, which, you know,
mm-hmm. Great idea.
Maybe not Roman candles.
The best plan. Yeah.
But then this guy Petey just like takes the punk. I'm like, well, we should probably probably put this out. And he just takes the sparkler, throws it in a litter box, and goes out.
Mm-hmm.
And he just goes, "That's punk rock." And I was like, you know what? Kind of was. Yeah. It was kind of cool.
Well, I mean that point about the Stones starting in blues and then becoming their own, you know,
right,
force.
Right, because once they start doing their own thing, it's not at all just, you know, right. It's not even like Clapton still adjacent. It becomes its total own thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's mm-hmm. pretty much exactly where Shields' essay ends. He writes, "If asked, many successful writers will freely admit that much of their early work was characterized by an attempt to mimic other writers whom they admired, and it took this period of imitation for them to develop the skills necessary for them to find their literary voice."
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of something I like to talk about when we first start imitation in class is, you know, to learn any skill, you look at the masters and try and do what they do.
Brett, I noticed that you have a packet and a book sitting in front of you. Did you want to talk about these texts at all?
Sure. The book, it'd be one that I think y'all would really dig, or anybody, poetry lovers, and there's a lot of music in here too. It's my friend Chris Straffolino. In the here, they are subtitles, notes to a poetry syllabus.
Mm.
So a lot of it looks like great critiques of all these different authors and things, mostly like fairly modern stuff. But then he also has this another extra element of how you would bring this into the classroom, or he's a teacher himself, and you know what he's done, what's worked, and so that's fun.
Cool.
The packet is I was thinking about with the whole self-portrait thing.
Yeah,
I've never actually written a self-portrait. You know, I never really thought about doing that. The closest thing I can think of is the sort of like all those O'Hara poems where he's just chronicling his walks through this, you know, the city.
Lunch and
mm-hmm.
yeah,
and lunch poems. Lot, yeah. But there's one I'm really trying to think of. Is it called Steps? I feel like it's annoying because I meant to look it up. But it's like the ultimate of that, you know, I did this, I did that, but it's all like dazzling and brilliant. Yeah, one thing I've been doing, and it's been for like, it's been all many years, like just on my phone, these poems are called Verses. So like just on my phone now, I have like the new batch of 400, but I probably have thousands of these things because it's compulsive. So, you know, it's originally just this versus that, these kind of list poems that you kind of like stack things together. And it could be 8 lines, it could be 20.
Yeah.
But then it gets, well, for me, again, people are like, oh, are you doing all this? I'm like, it's a compulsion. It's not cool, you know. But that's, as time went on, I've started to sort of like unloosen the, because the parameter of that is by putting the like this versus this, the V period in the middle of the line. It's almost like putting a speed bump.
Yeah.
Like it's going to disrupt the lyric just by nature.
Yeah.
So I've eventually kind of dissolved it back where I don't always do the verses every time, but this one is a little bit of that, and then it's basically just after the snow we just had, the Saturday after when things were thawing. So I don't really have a self-portrait problem. The closest one I have is just like a portrait of a walk I took in Gentilly not that long ago.
You want to read it?
Would you
to
like
us?
To share it with us?
All right, read it.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, so this is called Gentilly Dog Walk on a Saturday After a Thaw. Warhol versus Warthog. The galgorithm of spent fireworks belt and milk duds carton. Coconut lotion and burnt coffee smell. Beheaded Pez dispenser by the Andy aficionados sipping Yakamine. Dirty Bible on a bench open to Leviticus 23:24. Rotten gazebo, glorious sunshine. And the vibrant ruins of the Bacchus Lounge. Dude in a Saints jacket says, 50 degrees never felt so good. Mr. Bingle got Mardi Gras Janist. Pontchartrain Gateway. Blue Jay and Zulu. Pyracantha, why don't you? Relict snow hinge on the St. Rock neutral ground. I don't think you can put the mud flap lady in a hoopty car, can you? My first love was a Weimaraner. I could do this all day long.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, I was thinking that's kind of the closest I've come to like a self-portrait is just like portrait of a walk.
It would be interesting to lead your class in a this versus this exercise.
No,
to play.
That's what I was. I was saying I did a workshop at the poetry festival last year. Basically, me and my friend Chris Chipman. This is like a cool thing. So, I had Roger Kamenetz as a teacher at LSU when I was an undergraduate.
Cool.
So my friend Chris had Roger as a teacher in the MFA program 25 years later. And so we ended up writing a couple of books of poetry together. And Roger always goes to the T-Rex parade. The pro tip is the most books of poetry I've ever sold, ever, like way more than a reading. We had like a girl with a cigarette tray. You know, the cigarette girl.
Mm-hmm.
You
have the thing. At the parade? Yeah.
And she sold them at the parade, and we just sold gobs of them. But,
of poetry books.
Yeah.
Decked out like a cigarette girl from a 40s movie theater.
The first book was called The T-Rex Parade. I should say that. You know, it's not exactly about
the parade.
So it
was on,
it was on brand.
Theme,
or
whatever.
Right. While they're drunk, you
contextually
just
appropriate.
You know, while they're, you know.
Preying on the drunk to buy poetry.
Yeah.
Exactly. Which is what better market is
that's our market, yeah.
Right.
It's like this stores in the French Quarter sell dumb hats. But like the coolest book signing I ever did and probably ever will do. Because so Roger was over the moon because he's like, he thinks it's so cool that two of his students wrote a book together that, it, you know, from both ends of his teaching career. But like he bought the book and he was holding it up and like I signed it like while parading past.
Nice.
Nice.
Like it's never going to get better than that.
Yeah.
But when me and Chris did the versus workshop at the poetry festival last year, and that was the nutty part, is that Roger came. So like he was one
to
of the students.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh, you know,
he was like my teacher.
Yeah.
But basically we just took some of the verses that we each wrote and just knocked out half of the items, and then they had to like fill them in.
Yeah. that reminds me of a sort of a play activity that I experienced the first time when I was very young. I was in a creative writing class taught by Ralph Adamo. And it was just we filled out like I guess subordinate dependent clauses and then independent clauses and then shuffled them all up, put them in a hat, and then pulled them out at random. And I did that last year with my classes, just as like an activity at the beginning of class to get us kind of playing and you know, working together. And yeah, that came to mind, that just putting at random a dependent clause and an independent clause together, that we've all just written ahead of time. Yeah.
I don't really know what this means, but I kind of do. I've heard that, like, you know, they used to grow Tabasco peppers on Avery Island, but now they just grow the seed peppers there, which then gets sent all over the world to grow more Tabasco peppers. But the cool thing about, like, so many poems, if you really think about it, maybe not so much the self-portraits, but there's always some kind of juxtaposition or opposition of two things that then create this other thing. So then once you do the verses, they're like super fun in themselves, but then they each, like any one of them could be like a seed for a whole other poem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's
cool. Totally. Oh, that's cool.
I wanted to ask if anyone has any final thoughts.
I'll have a final thought. It kind of goes, what you're saying about the virtuoso aspect and like to me, like I always considered like T.S. Eliot sort of like arena rock, whereas Ted Berrigan is like The Clash, you know. But the same friend I was just talking about with the Tresno Char, she grew up in Nicaragua, so when I would write a new poem, she'd just be like, okay, cool, read me a poem. Almost like I just wrote a new song, oh, play it for me, right? Whereas in the United States, like the way poetry's taught in lower school, it's like every poem has some, you know, Easter egg of truth, like deep meaning buried in it, and you have to find it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then people don't, and then they get frustrated, and then they, you know, hate poetry.
Yeah.
So like basically I'm saying the way poetry is taught in America, the United States of America, at the lower level, just kind of ruins it for them.
Yeah.
Whereas totally. My friends from South America and other places, to them it's just fun the same way music is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's like, that's how it's supposed to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like the poem I just read, there's no deep meaning.
Right.
It's just what I saw walking around Gentilly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've found that a couple of poems, Introduction to Poetry, Billy Collins, is a great poem to sort of start to break down that idea.
That's a cool one, yeah.
And then one that I've been teaching more recently is The Secret by Denise Levertov.
Oh, cool.
Both are sort of trying to dismantle that idea that a poem has a truth buried in it, and if you don't find it, you failed.
I mean, one of the funniest moments, I'm friends with Frank Sherlock, who ended up becoming the Poet Laureate of Philadelphia, but we were in a line checking out in Philly, and I turned to him, I said, you know, people always think that, like, poets are supposed to be deep and prophets. It's like, I'm really one of the shallowest people I know. I'm just good at writing poetry. And his eyes got, like, really crazy because I had, like, broken the poetry code or something. I guess I was, like, half joking, half not.
Yeah.
But it just goes to that thing. Like, yeah, it's not, like, a huge deep meaning.
Well, it's simplicity, right? I mean, you know, students will light up when I've had it happen sometimes with the red wheelbarrow, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's just, oh, yeah, he's or talking about
it. Just to say.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. He's talking about a wheelbarrow, people.
Yeah.
I'm a big, personally, I will admit, I am a big sucker for big meaning stuff. I totally am.
No, but, I'm just saying it's not always the thing.
But that's not always the thing. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to have some kind, and it's like, but in the specificity of the object, what does this wheelbarrow mean to this person? That could be something he uses every single day. It may not have something to do with the existential qualities of the human condition, but in a way, it's like, this is, you know, your daily life. You walk around, you walk the dog. You know, and there's something of value in that. And people kind of get that a little bit, I think, sort of. It takes something out of the whole deep meaning into the experience of the thing itself, you know?
It's just the don't overthink it.
Yeah.
You're talking about Mint Snowball, the essay?
Yeah,
the essay. Where they lose the family recipe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I always like compare it to the song MacArthur Park, which is just like the weirdest. Have you ever read the lyrics? Do you know this?
I know the song vaguely, and I don't really know the lyrics super well.
Yeah. I mean, I could go.
MacArthur Park is frightening in the dark.
I mean, we don't really.
The key part is, I know. Someone left the cake out in the rain.
Right.
Okay, someone. That's weird. Not you?
Yeah.
And then it took all day to bake it, but then this work gets super weird. I'll never have that recipe again. Why?
Okay. Yeah.
Like you fumbled that into the fire when you don't even use a stove to make a cake. Like,
yeah.
But the whole poem is really, it seems like, I mean, the song is about somebody having like a nervous breakdown in a park. It's the only thing that kind of, the lyrics are just completely the kookiest.
Yeah.
But I'll never have that recipe again.
Yeah.
It's like the kicked out of the garden too soon moment.
Yeah.
Well, Matt, Brat, we have really enjoyed having y'all on the podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah,
my
that
pleasure.
Was fun.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, and thank you.
Thank you, listener.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the English 101 Experiment. Special thanks to Christopher Nicotera, instructor of music business at Delgado Community College, for his recording assistance. All music heard during this episode comes from the Free Music Archive. Specific titles and artists are listed on the English 101 Experiment website.